Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Big news! One generous Marketplace fan, Dr. Joe Rush from Florida, is offering to match the next $50,000 in donations to Marketplace. And every single gift gets us closer to a critically important May fundraising goal. So please, give right now and double your impact thanks to this generous match. Go to marketplace.org/donate. 6 months it has been. What has changed economically, do you suppose? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 24th day of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. 6 months ago to this very day, the Russian army and Russian air and missile forces invaded Ukraine. To date, including the $3 billion package the White House announced today, the United States has given Kyiv a little more than $13 billion in aid and arms. This is now, it seems, a war of attrition, in which the economic realities in Russia and in Ukraine are going to become more relevant the longer it lasts. So we've gotten Dr. Christy Ironside back on the phone. She's an assistant professor of Russian history at McGill University. We've gotten her on the phone to talk things over. Dr. Ironside, welcome back.
Great to chat with you again, Kai.
So when we spoke 6 months ago today, actually, one of the things we talked about was the sanctions effort and trying to cut Russia basically out of the global economy. With the understanding that you're a professor of history, not a professor of economics, do you think that's happened?
Well, yes and no. Yes, in the sense that many different firms have pulled out of the Russian market. At this point, I think the count is up to around 1,000. So McDonald's pulled out, Starbucks, all these kinds of companies have left. So in that sense, Russia is definitely very economically isolated. But in another very important sense, it's not, in the sense that it is still selling oil and gas to the rest of the world, particularly to Europe. So it's still connected in that very important way.
And that's manifesting actually in the ruble, too, right? When we talked last time, the ruble had cratered is the only word to think of it. And now it's not only stable, but back to where it was like in 2014 or something.
Absolutely. This has been one of the really surprising things that has happened since that. In part, the reason it's happening is because right now there is no demand for products in US dollars, in euros within Russia itself, because it is so cut off from the world economy. And it's also happening because the Russian government has implemented de facto capital controls. So it's forcing Gazprom, its, you know, energy provider, to repatriate its profits in rubles. So it's generating demand for the ruble, which is helping to keep the ruble up behind the scenes.
Let me just take it sideways for a second, just because you mentioned Gazprom and natural gas obviously is a huge story in Europe. Prices are up here as well in the States. Winter's coming, as the saying goes, and natural gas is going to get more dear. And that's only going to benefit the Russians, right, and the Russian government.
They're definitely counting on this. I think this is one of their strategies, is they're trying to promote this disunity that's in Europe around this issue. Yeah. They're counting on people not wanting to pay more to heat their homes when it gets colder in a couple of months' time, and that putting domestic pressure on governments to ease those sanctions.
Are you in contact with people in Russia, whether Moscow or elsewhere?
I am.
What are they telling you?
I mean, to be honest, the people that I have still in Russia are quite guarded. But a lot of my friends and colleagues have left. I have a lot of people who now are living in Serbia, in Georgia, in Armenia, you know, maybe hopefully not permanently. A lot of them, of course, want to go back. Their home is there. But they're very worried. They don't know what to do in the short term. And these are people who don't support the government or who, you know, are just extremely horrified by what's going on. So it's a very complicated situation at the moment for everybody involved.
I went back and I listened to the interview that you and I did at the end of February. And the last question I asked you was what you thought it might take for the Russian population to, and look, granting all the repression and hardball tactics that the Putin government engages in, I asked you what you thought it would take for the Russian people to say, that's it, we don't want this anymore. Are you surprised the Russian people have lasted 6 months?
Yes and no. I mean, I think part of it is that we're still seeing them being sheltered from a lot of this. This isn't to say that people don't understand this is happening, but their information world is very different than ours. Let's put it like that. And again, I always keep saying this, but I think it's really worth remembering. Russia's a very big place. It's very diverse. And the kinds of people that I interact with, I have a very urban life when I go to Russia. I live in Moscow. Mm. My friends, my colleagues are there. My archives are there. But it's a very different world than when you're out in the provinces, when you're in some of these smaller places where they're less connected to, you know, global chains like McDonald's or things like this. So if you're a young IT professional in Moscow, this is disastrous to your living standards and less so to somebody living in Siberia.
Right.
So we're still watching this happened kind of in slow motion, and I'm not entirely sure where it's all headed, if I'm being perfectly honest.
Look, you're the expert, so if you don't know, I don't know who's going to. Let me ask you one last thing, and then I'll get out of your hair. If I call you when I call you in 6 months, and this invasion and war now are a year old, what are you going to be looking for between now and then? What are you looking at?
I'll be looking at what's going on domestically in the economy. If prices continue to rise in Russia, inflation is definitely affecting them. So the fact that the ruble is doing fine is a very imperfect measure of living standards, because of course you can't buy dollars in Russia right now. You can't, you know, easily engage in trade. And I'll also be watching brain drain. This is another thing that's going on right now. Lots of young people are leaving. I read statistics this morning that we're talking about potentially millions of people who have left since this started. So those are things that I'll be watching for.
Dr. Kristi Ironside, she's an assistant professor of history, Russian history rather, at McGill University up in Montreal. Professor Ironside, thanks for your time. I do appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Kai.
We were talking Russian oil sales there. By the way, Dr. Ironside and I, Russian oil is known as Urals, the same way the U.S. benchmark is called West Texas Intermediate and the global standard is Brent. Russian oil is Urals. Anyway, thought it might be interesting for you to know that even though Moscow is still selling plenty of oil, it's happening at a steep discount. Brent crude today, $97.36 a barrel. Urals, Russian oil, $73.16 a barrel. Wall Street on this Wednesday, mostly green. Details, numbers, y'all know the drill. Wherever you fall on the spectrum of whether it was a good idea or not, the announcement today from President Biden that he's canceling some student debt, while a big deal for millions of Americans, does kind of dodge the root cause. Higher education in this country is incredibly, and that's putting it politely, expensive. In the past 50 years, tuition at both public and private schools has more than tripled. That's even after accounting for inflation. So Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reminds us now why tuition is so high.
Heidi Graham feels slightly ill when she thinks about the $83,000 she paid for her son to attend NYU just for this year.
The most my parents ever paid in tuition was $801, and I'm not that old. I mean, I'm 52.
Graham went to a public college in California. NYU is private, and her son wants to work in film.
Those particular careers, a lot of it is who you know. And it does help you to go to a more exclusive school, or you hope. Maybe I've bought into what everybody's selling.
One thing schools are selling, the faculty. Catherine Hill's an economist with the education nonprofit Ithaca SNR. She's also the former president of Vassar College. She says the wages faculty and administrators command have gone up in recent years.
If you break down costs, about 60 to 70% of costs are driven by compensation for people that work at institutions.
Colleges also provide more stuff than they did 50 years ago, like mental health services and career counseling.
Very large shares of the applicants are willing and able to pay those prices. If they weren't, schools wouldn't be charging them.
Public college prices are less eye-watering, but still way higher than they used to be. That's because those colleges get less money from the government now. Betsy Mayotte is president of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors.
All the states have de-invested in higher education.
Mayotte says colleges should have a bigger stake when it comes to the loans that students take out.
If it was up to me, I would hold schools accountable for anybody that defaulted on their loans within 10 years of leaving the school.
One downside of that is people who need to borrow might be less likely to be admitted in the first place. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Consider this your midweek reminder that the Grade A economic news of this week comes Friday. The latest readings on inflation will be upon us, and that big speech by Fed Chair Jay Powell out in Jackson Hole. But believe it or not, the Fed's got more going on right now than a speech about when and how high the central bank is going to send interest rates. Way less publicized is the Fed's unwinding of its big bond buying program. It was called quantitative easing when the Fed was buying bonds. It is now called quantitative tightening. Another way the Fed is trying to push interest rates up to get inflation less inflated. That unwinding, though, is set to speed up quite a bit next month. So Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has this primer.
The Fed uses the bond market as an indirect way of raising or lowering interest rates. Economist Chris Rupke at Forward Bonds says this interest rate tool works mostly in the background.
Well, it's a mystery. It's done by the man behind the curtain.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
In The Wizard of Oz, the man behind the curtain had a hot air balloon. So does the Fed. The Fed blew up the balloon during the pandemic, ratcheting up its bond buying so it flooded financial markets with money. With plenty of cash to go around, interest rates fell. People spent more, stimulating the economy. Now the Fed is starting to undo that.
They're trying to deflate the balloon. They're trying to pull money out of the economy.
That's former Fed economist Claudia Sahm. She says when the bonds the Fed is holding on its balance sheet mature, the Fed isn't reinvesting that money back into the bond market. The Fed's balance sheet shrinks, and it's going to shrink faster starting in September.
And if there's less money out there, well, it gets more expensive to borrow money.
Then consumers and businesses buy less, the economy cools, and inflation falls. A hike in mortgage rates, for example, ripples through the economy, says Tulane University economist Gary Hoover.
As everything that's tied to housing will be impacted.
Sales of things like furniture and appliances fall, pushing inflation down, at least in theory, if the Fed's bond balloon lands in the right place. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
I don't know if it's been on every big retailer's earnings call, but certainly most of them, including Macy's and Nordstrom this week, saying their inventories are too high. They overbought during the early days of the pandemic when consumer goods spending was high and supply chains were uncertain. Now we're just spending money in different ways. But what do you suppose is a retailer to do? Sell their inventory to liquidators is what Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has more on those secondary sellers.
Every item in a store has a shelf life. And no, we're not just talking fruits and vegetables, but patio furniture and throw pillows. The longer they sit around, the more they cost the store. Jason Miller, a professor of supply chain management at Michigan State, says when markdowns fail,
what you'll do is you'll call essentially a liquidator, and they will be invited to place bids on things. You're not allowed to cherry pick. It's here's pallets of product. Give me a number for it.
It's a risky deal. Have you ever seen that reality show on A&E called Storage Wars, where people blindly bid on abandoned storage units?
Another box of bagged up trash.
The pallets liquidators buy often include returned items. But lately, Dosti Lenga, CEO of American Liquidations in Connecticut, says stuff arrives in pristine condition because stores are dumping excess inventory.
Everything is brand new. We're right out of the box. It hasn't even hit the shelves yet.
Lenga buys more than 20 truckloads from Home Depot, Walmart, and Target a week. Most of it is resold to businesses like scratch and dent appliance stores and flea markets. He makes a 30% profit. Other liquidators sell directly to the public. Angus McConnell owns Miami Valley Liquidation Center in Ohio.
We put out 10,000 items into 30 bins on Friday, and anything in those bins is $7 that Friday.
The price drops a dollar each day after. McConnell says business is good, but it's getting harder. He got into this a decade ago.
There was less people like myself in the business then.
He says he's paying about 35% more for goods than he did a year ago because of competition. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I did. I took my 32 hours and I loved it.
I mean, I can't see why you wouldn't, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 59 points today, about a 10%, 32,969. The NASDAQ added 50 points, 50 points, 0.4%, 12,431. The S&P 500 tacked on 12 points, nearly 0.3%, 41.40 there. Peloton is moving beyond its core direct-to-consumer business model. It's made a deal with Amazon to offer some of its exercise equipment and accessories there. Peloton has been, well, struggling, of late, you might say. Earlier this month, it announced some layoffs, store closures, other cost-cutting measures. Peloton, ticker symbol PTON, by the by, gained 20%, 20%. Petco, ticker symbol, come on, it's really good. Anybody? Really? WOOF, woof, Petco, come on, how good is that? Miss Wall Street forecast, you might say it was a dog. Oh, sorry. It also cut its outlook for the full year. Higher costs are apparently the culprit. Shares dropped 8.8%. Bonds, sorry, I got to squeeze this in. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.10%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
Big news! One generous Marketplace fan, Dr. Joe Rush from Florida, is offering to match the next $50,000 in donations to Marketplace. And every single gift gets us closer to a critically important May fundraising goal. So please give right now and double your impact thanks to this generous match. Go to marketplace.org/donate. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We are going to get back into inventories now following Kristen's story about big retailers from Nordstrom and Walmart and Target to all the rest of them, trying to get rid of all that extra stuff they've got. It's not just the biggies, though. A lot of small businesses have been trying to bring down their inventories, too. Marketplace's Justin Ho talked to some of them about the challenge of keeping the right amount of stuff and the right kinds of stuff on their shelves.
Managing inventory is all about making a prediction about how much stuff you will sell based on how much you've sold in the past. And right now, making that prediction is not easy.
I can't look at what happened in 2020 and 2021 and think it's going to repeat itself in 2022.
That's Brandilyn Green, owner of Voice of Hair, a company that sells hair products. She works with manufacturers to make things like shampoos and conditioners, and she supplies the packaging, things like plastic bottles and caps. And throughout the pandemic, she's been stocking up on that packaging. But now,
I have a lot of inventory and I just have been honestly trying to bleed through that instead of buying more and sitting on it.
That's because sitting on all that packaging means tying up a lot of cash. And right now, she'd rather hold on to that cash since the economy is so uncertain. As a result, she's trying a new strategy, asking the manufacturers that make the hair products she sells if she can use their packaging instead.
And instead of me buying it and shipping to them, I'm just using what they have so I don't have to keep all of that in my own warehouse. And I also don't have to pay as much for stuff that I'm not using right now.
Green says buying packaging from her manufacturers ends up costing her more for every bottle. But she says that cost is worth it since it lets her buy only what she needs.
Versus just buying a bunch of inventory, putting it in a warehouse, and then it might take me 6 months to, you know, go through it all.
Business owners aren't only worried about the next 6 months. They're also concerned about how business is going right now.
Business is down.
That's Tracy Mangano. She's the owner of CardSmart Greetings, a greeting card and gift shop in Buffalo, New York.
The inflation, it's killing us. The prices are absolutely ridiculous for some things. So I'm just watching my inventory because people don't want to pay that price.
Mangano says she's been trying to stock more budget-friendly items, like cheaper gift cards, clothing, and jewelry. Meanwhile, she's not stocking as many specialty items, like, say, greeting cards that congratulate you for getting a driver's license.
Maybe I'm not going to reorder that right away. It's not the same as getting, you know, a wife birthday card or a sympathy card or an anniversary or wedding card. Those are the ones you got to keep in stock.
Keeping the right products in stock often means taking out loans to fill the shelves. And that's another reason why managing inventory is so difficult right now. Borrowing is more expensive now that interest rates are rising. Pat Whalen manages imports at Sahadi's, a grocery store in Brooklyn that carries products from the Mediterranean and the Middle East.
You know, if you got $1 million worth of product and you were paying 2% to finance it, and now you're paying 6% to finance it, you know, it's going to hit the bottom line pretty hard.
And given how much inventory other businesses have built up during the pandemic, Whalen says it's hard to even find warehouse space to store his inventory.
Somebody will say, yeah, I have a little space. How much do you have? And you tell them, well, I'd like to put in like 500 pallets. And they go, well, no, we can't do that.
So Whalen says the grocery store is whittling down its inventory. That means slowing down his imports to help free up space.
Just to kind of spread it out a little bit and create some breathing room on the storage side here.
In the meantime, Whalen says he's not going to stock a single new item until next year at the earliest. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
You'd like to work less, if you could, right? I mean, even if you really like your job, it'd be nice to do it maybe not 5 days a week. And we hear about companies doing that, four-day weeks to keep people happy. But I caught a piece in Fast Company the other day about how four-day work weeks aren't for everybody. Yet. Rebecca Brooks is the CEO of Alter Agents. It's the company in the aforementioned Fast Company story. Rebecca, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about this here for a second. You think 4 day week, and my guess would be most people hearing this are going to say, oh, yeah, they work Monday through Thursday or Tuesday through Friday. That is not what you did. What did you do and why?
We're a really high end client service market research company. So our clients include like Netflix and Snapchat. They're on all the time. So we needed to be on all the time. And we didn't want to just shift the hours. 10-hour days are very hard. And so we did kind of a complicated alternating day. Everybody picked their days. We had a lot of rules around, you know, not too many team members from the same team could be out. But we made it fun. We did kind of like a lottery thing at the beginning of every month where everybody got to pick their days and put it on the calendar.
I work schedule as fun. I don't know, but maybe that's just me. I don't know. But clearly it didn't work out the way you wanted to. Before we get to that, though, one of your goals was that your clients would never know you were doing this, that it would be transparent to your clients, which I guess goes with the high-end thing.
That's right. We debated about telling our clients before we began the pilot program and felt like actually a marker of success for us was that they wouldn't know that there was any difference in our level of service. And so if our clients had started to say like, hey, people aren't getting back to me quickly enough, or, you know, I feel like things are slipping through the cracks, then we would have known that from their end, this was not working.
Did you get a nasty phone call from Reed Hastings at Netflix saying, hey, we can't get our calls answered, or was it okay with them?
No one noticed. And when we started talking about it publicly, yeah, they were surprised.
All right. Spoiler alert here. It didn't work. You went back to regular after 10 weeks. What happened? Why did you as the boss say, you know what? Not working. Got to go back.
Yeah. Well, we're researchers at heart. So we actually did a pre-post survey and we let everybody know that this was a pilot program. We did a survey around mental health. How many hours are you working? What is your level of stress? And then after 10 weeks, we came back and did the survey again. And a lot of the numbers that we expected to go up went down. Hmm. And I think that what it came down to was that there were two types of people. And I want to clarify that neither one of them is wrong. But there were sort of boundary setters, right, who were hard-lined about taking that day.
Yep.
And there were people that would say, well, I'll take this meeting or I'll finish this up in the morning. And they were looser with that. And so it made the boundary setters feel very uncomfortable that other people weren't setting their boundaries. It made the people that were coming in and doing a little bit feel resentful. And ultimately, the idea of having the day and not really feeling like you could fully take the day or feel guilty about taking the day was more stressful than working a five-day week.
Yeah, for sure. So look, is there a situation in which you would try this again? Would you make some tweaks or are you done and you got to be 5 days and that's just what works for this company?
No, we are absolutely committed to figuring out how to make it work. I really believe that, especially for knowledge workers, you need that extra time. And so if we can get to an overstaffed position, and by that I mean that when somebody takes vacation or is on sick leave or maternity, the rest of the staff doesn't feel stressed. They feel like they've got the resources they need to work through that. If we can get to that point, then I think it's a real possibility that we could make this four-day work week happen.
What did you, as the woman in charge, do? You're the CEO. Did you take your 32 hours or was that not reasonable for you?
I did. I took my 32 hours and I loved it. I think
Good for you. Good for you. That's great.
I think I was the only person in the company that was actually quite happy with a 4-day work week. So it was hard. It was hard to admit defeat and give it up. But, you know, better for everybody that we're on 5 days for now until we can figure out a better system.
Rebecca Brooks, she is the CEO of Alter Agents. That's a market research firm here in Los Angeles. Rebecca, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, a not great story I saw in Bloomberg this morning. Some data from the National Energy Assistance Directors Association, which is, yes, the energy assistance industry's lobbying group. It says there are 20 million households in this economy, about one out of every six, that are behind on their utility bills. I ought to point out here that natural gas prices hit a shale era record the other day. That is the highest nat gas prices have been ever since we started fracking to get all that extra gas. And oh, by the way, winter is coming. All right, off we go. Your moment of economic context, of course, comes first. It's brought to you today by the California Air Resources Board. There's a new rule going into effect out here tomorrow that says by 2035, every car sold here in California is going to have to be free of fossil fuel emissions. And since it is happening here, chances are good it's going to happen a whole lot of places. California is going away, the biggest car market in this whole economy. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Dorado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.